By way of introduction, I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy with a continuing interest in pharmacy leadership. These conversations with successful pharmacists are intended to provide the audience with useful techniques. I'd like to welcome today Bruce E. Scott. Bruce received his undergraduate pharmacy degree from the University of Wisconsin, his master's from the University of Kansas, and completed an accredited residency at the University of Kansas Medical Center. Bruce has held the following leadership positions within health systems: assistant director, director, and corporate vice president. In corporations, he's been a senior vice president and chief pharmacist, chief operating officer, and most recently, a corporate president for Accredo Infusion Services. Welcome, Bruce. Let's start by you talking about being a president of a publicly traded corporation. What does that entail?
Well, thanks, Sarah, and thanks for the opportunity to be here today. I've been very fortunate to be part and an exec in publicly traded companies, and you named some of those on the intro. In my positions, I had an executive title, including president title, to run a specific portion of a business or a business within a larger corporation. I was never the person that dealt with Wall Street or investors. My roles were leading the business and successfully leading that business. So in my most recent role as president of Infusion Services for Accredo, just to give you some concept of that, it was a large business that if you use indicators of size, we're about over $3 billion in revenue, had about 2,500 employees, most of which were healthcare providers, pharmacists, nurses, dietitians. And my role as president there was really focused on providing a service that met the needs of our customers and our patients. And also, I spent a significant amount of my time planning for the future, that strategy, that vision of what our company's growth would be for the next several years and the strategy to achieve that growth. And that's the part that I'll tell you as I transitioned from the hospital health system world to a for-profit publicly traded company. That whole piece about as an exec, you know, your challenge is providing the service and growing the company. And that growth factor, I would say, is where I spent a significant amount of my time.
So how did you go about that? Could you drill down a little bit for us about how you went about that strategic planning?
Well, sure. A lot of the skill set of executives is transferable from one set into the other. But I will tell you the difference that I found in operating within a healthcare system, running a pharmacy enterprise within a healthcare system, as opposed to running a company that is your business. You know, in a healthcare system, you know, the concept of establishing a vision or establishing a strategic plan, there are lots of similarities. One thing that I will tell you that I've learned from my days in the for-profit world, that if I was ever to redo my days in the healthcare system role and lead in pharmacy enterprises, that I've learned is the whole concept of marketing, sales, account management, because that's really needed to grow and advance a company. And I think I could have benefited from those skills when I was in a leadership role for pharmacy and health systems. The concept of how do you position yourself and how do you sell yourself, whether you're selling yourself to a potential customer in the business world, or as I reflect back on health systems, selling yourself to hospital or health system leadership. How do you put the best foot forth and really articulate your value to that organization is something I think I'd be much better at. And that's a skill set that I had to quickly develop as I moved to the publicly traded companies, that whole concept of managing an account, selling in, your marketing, and really advancing your company through revenue growth. That was a learning experience for me.
Could you translate that back into, if you were the director of pharmacy again, specifically how you'd go about doing that?
Okay. As for example, I mentioned account management. Well, when I was a hospital pharmacy director and health system director, I don't know that I thought of all of those groups that we're providing service to as accounts. I thought of them as colleagues, peers, part of the organization. But in reality, if I could transfer the knowledge or skills or thinking that I gained in the public sector about how do you manage an account and how do you sell yourself to an organization or a potential customer, utilization of those skills toward our physician colleagues, our nursing colleagues, our hospital administration, treating them in a manner of we're providing a service for you, and managing that relationship as you do a customer-vendor relationship, I think would have allowed me to better represent and advance pharmacy in those organizations. So just thinking of them in that customer relationship, I think would be very helpful. I would have benefited from that.
How did you learn those skills, or in other words, how could our audience learn those skills?
Well, I learned them through being thrown into the fire in publicly traded companies, as you really had to satisfy your customers. If not, you lost the business. And that's one thing that's a bit different that I've learned in my work in public customers is it's your brand, and your brand is represented to that customer, and they decide to buy or not. Where within the system of health system, it's the health system brand, and you're just a component of that in providing service, a very valuable component, but your component, you don't lose or win the customer very frequently. So that's where I had to learn it right away.
But what you do find in the health system is frustration with pharmacy.
Absolutely.
If you haven't done a good job, correct?
Absolutely. We can certainly drive business, customers, physicians away from your organization. So I would say to any hospital or health system pharmacy director to consider yourself as part of that organization that will retain customers, and your customers are not only your patients, but your physicians and other colleagues, and also get new ones.
In the companies, as you moved into being president, how did you establish the vision and get people to buy into that?
Well, you know, the vision is very similar in many ways, or the process of establishing the vision is very similar in many ways that a health system executive or a health system pharmacy executive would do in their organization. It's always key that the vision for your organization is aligned with the vision of the overall. And then once you understand the overall and can align, then it's what's the opportunity, what's the future opportunity for your organization, and where do you want to be at what milestones in time. That was very similar on in the for-profit companies that I worked in. My company, my business, needed to be aligned with the overall, and then it became how do I grow my business in that context, and I think that's the same. Connecting with people, we as execs have to have good communication strategies, good communication plans, and they have to be able to get down to the line employees. I always actually enjoy the conversation with employees. To have the conversation, not have the message or talking points, but I always found that the conversation of our direction was more value than sending out the message or sending out the document of our vision. So connecting with people for me was mostly about dialogue and the opportunity to have small group dialogue around the vision. That was always helpful. And it also got people involved and made them feel included, because actually I learned as much as I shared.
And in this world of email, would you do it that way?
Oh, if I use email for anything like that, it would be a follow-up. It's not the primary communication a tool. I don't find email useful or effective in communicating strategy. It's a vehicle for the document getting out. It's not a communication tool, I think, for strategy.
Okay, great. Let's back up a little bit in some of the other corporate positions that you've held, and have you tell us a little bit about what your responsibilities were when you were the Chief Operating Officer for McKesson Med Management?
Okay. McKesson Medication Management was a company that we provided contract services for healthcare organizations around the pharmacy services. I really enjoyed that position. And actually, that was the first position that I had outside a healthcare system. And in many ways, it was very similar to what I was doing within healthcare systems. It was just on a larger platform, more hospitals and more customers. But as Chief Operating Officer, I was responsible for primarily two functions of our organization. One is providing the service. So pharmacists that were practicing within medication management operations, I provided them the tools, I provided them protocols, the support they needed to be successful in their organization. And the second part of that was what I spoke to a bit earlier, was the account management. I was often the person, particularly for our large accounts, that went and met face to face with hospital administrators or people that had contracted and hired us to provide that service. And I'll tell you, that was a great learning because there is more than one time that I would tell you that I thought I knew what they wanted, and I was it was not accurate. But sitting down face to face, having that dialogue, you get crystal clear understanding of what they wanted. So I really enjoyed that role.
You then moved to Medco and became the Senior Vice President and Chief Pharmacist. How did you know it was time to leave, or how did that come about, and what were your responsibilities?
Well, it actually came about as a result of a decision within McKesson to divest medication management. And as I was looking for other opportunities, the Medco opportunity presented itself. And I enjoyed that role as well. The Medco opportunity gave me a chance to, one, learn a different practice of pharmacy, specifically mail pharmacy, pharmacy benefit management that I'd really not been exposed to in the past. The job was leader of professional practice within Medco and the chief pharmacist role. Professional practice within Medco was the organization that really decided or dictated the practice, the standards of practice for pharmacists within a very large organization. And leading that, you might imagine that we had all kinds of opportunities both to provide good pharmacy practice service as well as advance the practice of pharmacy. Use of technology was big. Making sure that pharmacists, when they had a prescription in front of them, also had pertinent information from patients' profile and also pertinent information from the literature that they can assess that particular therapy. So the professional practice organization was responsible for that. And I'll tell you, the greatest thrill of that, and particularly working in that organization, was our focus on medication safety. This was an organization that dispensed over 100 million prescriptions per year. And my organization was the leader in terms of medication safety within that environment. And I very much enjoyed that position.
Again, moving back in your career, when you move from health systems to the corporate world, that seems like a big change. What enticed you to do that?
I can't tell you that there was one thing. I was very happy in my role, and at that time I was working for Allina Hospitals and clinics within the Twin Cities. It was simply an opportunity to learn something different, to do something different. And it also gave me an opportunity to focus more back on pharmacy practice, as within my role in Allina, it had become broader. than pharmacy practice, which was a great experience in and of itself, and I did enjoy that. This was just an opportunity to do something different.
And when you went into pharmacy, when you took that step into the corporate world, was that your career plan all along?
No, not at all. I'd love to tell you that I had a career plan and that was the track that I was following, but that was certainly not the case. It was purely an opportunity that presented itself. I'll tell you what I was intrigued with is I find myself, as I look back on my career, I enjoy leadership challenges. And as I look back on the moves that I made, most of them were to pursue a leadership challenge and kind of a challenge to myself. It was an opportunity to learn something different and to lead a somewhat different of an organization.
What attracted you to pharmacy as a career choice?
I'd like to tell you that I had this all planned out, but that was not the case. Graduating from high school, I knew I'd go to college and went straight into college out of high school. My mom is a teacher, and that was an expectation that was drilled in all of us as we grew up. So I started college, and I was an undeclared major, and quickly figured out that I needed to get on a path of a major and align my financial situation with graduation. So I looked around at a number of majors, and an experience from high school helped me a bit, and that I'd worked in high school in a local pharmacy. And to be precise, I really didn't work in the pharmacy. I worked in the retail sector section of it, stocking shelves. But I enjoyed conversations with the pharmacist and what he seemed to do for patients. In talking with various counselors, pharmacy came up, and that was something that I related back to that experience. And what I heard from the counselor was the flexibility of a pharmacy degree, and that you could do a number of different things with it. And I also have always enjoyed sciences and math, and so that was something that seemed to fit as well. And it wasn't long after that conversation that those pieces just seemed to fall together, and I pursued the prerequisites to get into pharmacy school, and that started my pharmacy journey.
So when you graduated with your pharmacy degree, tell us about your first pharmacist job.
My first pharmacist job, and actually I would tell you that my first job relating to pharmacy was very important to me as well, as I worked my way through pharmacy school as a pharmacy technician at the University of Wisconsin Hospital. And that gave me a very an opportunity to closely observe the practice of pharmacy, which I thought was just great. And that's where I started getting excited about hospital of pharmacy. And working as a technician at that time at the University of Wisconsin, the pharmacy technicians administered medications. So I also got to know patients and had my own favorite patients as a pharmacy technician just through the medication administration relationship. Well, after graduation, and at that time, Wisconsin required an internship. So I completed my internship also at the University of Wisconsin and stayed on as in a staff pharmacist role at the University of Wisconsin. And I'll tell you, those were among the best times in practice. I very much enjoyed what I did, and I very much felt that I was part of the healthcare team and certainly the medication expert on that healthcare team.
And were you on a certain clinical service?
Yes. Well, as an intern, we rotated, but I spent a significant amount of time in an intensive care unit at the University of Wisconsin called TLC, Trauma and Life Support Center. And when I finished and took a staff role, that's the unit I worked. I continued in the intensive care unit.
So then you made the decision to do a residency and a master's program. Why do that?
You know, even though I very much loved what I did, I had that feeling of desire that I wanted to do more. And it was after several conversations with people, because at that time I was trying to make the decision between a master's program and a PharmD a program once I decided to go back. And I'll tell you, Sarah, this is the power of mentorship. And at some point I'd like to talk more about mentors. But one of my mentors at that time was Pam Pletz at the University of Wisconsin. And Pam, I am forever grateful to her for the time that she took to help me figure out my career path. And she gave her personal time to sit down and just talk through issues, as well as motivated me and giving me opportunities within a practice. But she led me to understand a bit about myself, and that I was looking for a role in which I could provide leadership. And that led me to the master's program and the residency. She also helped me understand that the concept that I had in my head, that you know, the practice of pharmacy was the University of Wisconsin, because that's all I'd ever seen. She helped me understand that there's a larger world of practice, and it might be beneficial for me to see practice in a different organization, which eventually led me to the University of Kansas.
So why don't we go ahead and talk more about mentors and mentorship?
Okay. You know, I would, and I have on many occasions shared with young leaders that if there's one thing I'd recommend for them and their career, is to have at least one, probably more, mentors, because that has been so important in my life. I mentioned Pam, and Sarah, I think you know that you are, you know, one of the individuals in my life that have helped me through my entire career, and I'm very appreciative of that and want to take any opportunity I can to say thanks. Another mentor, David Zills, has just always been there, and he's one of those people also that I pick up the phone at any time, even today, to call to say, what do you think of this? And why that's so important to me is that there are very few people in your life, when you get to the executive leadership level, that will tell you the truth and be very honest in terms of the positives that they see, as well as those opportunities that you should do something different or think of a different option. And to have that in your life is so important to your continued growth and development, because we all have those blind spots, and it's our mentors that help shine those spotlights on those areas that we need to give more thought to, or improve, or maybe do something different. So I found that to be one of the keys to any success I've had, is the mentors that I've had in my life that have been able to provide me direction.
So what advice do you have for the audience on how to find a good mentor?
You know, I would say oftentimes they're right around us. And as I've talked with our younger colleagues, I've heard things like, well, I don't want to search a person because they're so busy. And what they miss is that oftentimes, as we have gotten to the later stages of our career, we're looking for ways to give back. And through that mentor relationship, it's just absolutely huge. So I encourage them, don't be scared by someone's busy calendar. Also, go to someone that you know will be honest with you, that are going to tell you the things that you might not want to hear. You really don't need someone that's going to tell you you're great. I mean, my mom does a great job of that. So in a mentor, you need someone that's going to give you a 360 degree of whom you are. So if you can find that, and often those are people that know you very well, those are the individuals that I would suggest people. And if you can't find it all in one person, there's nothing wrong with having two or three.
So how do you maintain that relationship, or what's the value? How do you do that, I guess?
I think it's just, well, first of all, none of my mentors expect that I'm going to call every day. But for me, I like to talk with them, you know, several times a year, and when opportunity presents itself at national pharmacy meetings, set a morning for breakfast or an evening for dinner or a lunch opportunity. And if you can find yourself doing that, you know, a couple times a year, you'll find that there that will serve you well. And outside of that, it's just become the crisis moments. You know, my company was sold, I'm thinking about this opportunity, what do you think about that? But that ongoing meeting opportunity is where I find a great opportunity for continued just catch up updates. And other than that, it's just call people when you need them.
What did you look for in your first position out of your master's residency program?
You know, by that time in my career, Sarah, I had come to the conclusion that I wanted to go into a pharmacy leadership role. And you know, I've had this discussion with several people that are trying to make that decision for practice, and this is what I started to discover about myself, and it's become clearer to me over the years. One is, when I was a staff pharmacist, I got my joy in my job from helping patients one at a time or working with physicians one at a time. It was that day-to-day activity in which I could use my medication knowledge to help patients. And that happened, you know, repeatedly during the day. And if, you know, there was a bad outcome, you know, there was going to be another one in 5 minutes that was going to be good. So that's where my joy came from, the practice. As I went through the master's program and under Ear and Harold's guidance started to look at, you know, people and how to manage people, I started to get my joy in that case from helping others do well. It was no longer in my head about me being the player, if you were to use the sports team analogy. You know, I think of those players as our pharmacists, and as they are the stars. Now my role became one of more of a manager or a coach. How can I help them be better? And I very much enjoyed that. So that's where I was coming out of my residency program. I wanted to be able to help others be better. As I continued to advance in my career in terms of the scope of leadership, I'll carry that sports team analogy a little bit further, because if you go from the player to the coach and then maybe to the general manager, that's where that executive leadership comes into play. And the difference there is, as that executive, just as the general manager on a sports team, you're trying to build a system. You're deciding the operation. You're looking at the processes and engaging the systems that the entirety of the operation can be more successful. So you've got your coaches still there working with teams to help them do the best, but now you're removing barriers and putting an organization in place around the practice that can be successful. And you get your joy, you know, for me, the joy here moved from the day-to-day activity to seeing others and helping others do better. Now that joy is, do I have the right organization in place to be successful? Probably longer term, but still very satisfying as a leader.
That's a great way to express, I think, the evolution. After your first position outside of your master's residency, how did you know it was time to leave? How do you make those decisions?
You know, I don't think there's any magic to that. I remember the decision to leave the assistant director position at Kansas and move to the director position at United. And that was a very difficult position for many ways. One, emotionally for me, because it was the first time that I was leaving my mentors and I didn't have that safety net. But at the same time, it was the challenge of, can you really lead an organization? Do you have the skill set to do it? That probably was the biggest driver to test myself and my ability to lead.
So once you became a director, then you got additional administrative responsibilities within Allina. How did those skills come about, or those responsibilities?
You know, I think that was a result of leadership skills being transferable within the organization. The leadership skills that we develop in pharmacy, they certainly are transferable throughout the healthcare system. I will tell you, I did learn a lot here. And one thing that I learned is my passion was pharmacy. And while I could be a hospital administrator and have other organizations and be that administrator for others, you do have to move away from the practice of pharmacy because that role requires something different. And it's a rare individual that's able to move into that role and still keep connected as we did with the as I had previously with the practice of pharmacy. And that created kind of a gap for me. I missed that pharmacy organization, pharmacy connection.
So as you did move up, though, within health systems and then into the corporate world, did you attempt to stay in touch with pharmacy?
Oh, I've always stayed in touch with pharmacy. The differences in the things that you don't have as much, you know, I enjoyed pharmacy residence. So moving into hospital administration, my pharmacy director at that time, of course, gave me access, and I had a little bit of time with pharmacy residents, but I missed that time that I would have with them. So there are things like that. I wasn't as involved with ASHP because, rightfully so, the individuals that were practicing pharmacy needed to have the greater voice within ASHP. So yeah, there are parts that you miss, although you do stay in contact.
So when you spent time with residents, how do you do that effectively?
Well, that so much depends on the resident, I'll tell you in my experience, because they're all different. During the time that I was involved with residents, you know, I had some that had experience, work experience, others that did not. So their maturity around practice varied. And I would never try to make them the same. I just wanted to take them from where they were and give them an opportunity to grow. So I very much tried to vary the experience of a resident to meet where they were in their career.
So did you do that through projects, through time?
Did that through projects, the scope of a project, through, and for example, you might take a resident that doesn't have practice experience, and their project might need a significant amount of practice experience in taking with it, where you've got a resident that may have practiced for a couple years, and they may need to understand the relationship with other departments more. So I would tailor those projects, I would tailor our conversations to meet their experience level.
How do you teach a resident really the human interactions, the relationship building?
You know, that's a day-to-day feedback issue. And not only do you find that in resident, you find that with young individuals that you might hire into roles. You asked the question before, when you're communicating a strategic vision, do you send it by email? Well, I've got strong feelings on that. And I think that, you know, if you want to connect with staff and individuals, it's a conversation. You know, I would always want our residents to have conversations. I'd want them to be, you know, have a communication plan when they're going to roll something out and to review that plan with them to make sure that we're not missing people. Or if you're making a major change in how pharmacy is going to change how we operate, have you communicated with nursing? So it's that opportunity that forever presents itself as we're communicating within our health systems and working with residents to make sure that they've got that ability to get face-to-face and have the necessary dialogue.
You've been very active in ASHP, having been on council, serving on the board of directors, and being president. I think you were also, were you not involved in your state and local organizations?
Yes. That's I was actually president of the Greater Kansas City Society, state president within the Minnesota Society as well.
So why devote personal time to doing that? What's the values?
You know, I learned that firsthand, both from the pharmacy leadership at Wisconsin and also pharmacy leadership at Kansas. You and Harold were great role models of that. But I'll tell you, it took me to understand and to experience the value that you got. And the value that I got was a network of practitioners, the ability to call someone and say, how are you doing this? And I'll tell you, we in pharmacy shouldn't underestimate the value of that, because that doesn't happen in the business world, that you share policies and you share strategies and tactics of how to accomplish something. That is unique, I think, within our profession, and it's extremely valuable. But having that, and you know, the other thing that organizations gave is they gave me an opportunity to develop leadership skills. Working, you know, as the president of a state or local organization, to be able to just organize people and put together programming that meet the needs of a membership is a great way to start developing and getting experience. And it's super valuable experience too. The other thing it does is it exposes you to things like health policy. You know, we're very familiar with department policy, but what about health policy for populations and how that works and the impact and how policies can make a difference in practice? So it just, I think I say all that to say it gave me an opportunity to lead and an opportunity to have a broader vision of healthcare.
What were some of the issues that ASHP was facing when you were president in 1999?
What immediately comes to mind is the convention center in Orlando, Florida. And the key issue at that time is that the Institute of Medicine report, which got into details around medical error and including medication error, was released at that meeting. And although ASHP had been a longtime advocate of medication safety, that all of a sudden threw the whole issue of medication safety and medical error into the spotlight. And it was it presented a great opportunity for ASHP during my presidency to really move our strategies and initiatives around medication safety forward. And I'll never forget that, you know, that was released during that week, and all of a sudden we had press and media around the ASHP mid-year meeting, and I think that was just a great time.
You've also, you're currently serving or have served on the board of directors for the ASHP Education and Research Foundation. Describe what the foundation does and how it's different from ASHP.
Sure. Well, first of all, to anyone that's viewing this, if you have an opportunity to donate to the foundation, please do, because this is what it does for us. You know, ASHP is our membership organization, and it's really there to meet the educational representation needs of our membership. It's not there to really fund research. That's what our foundation does. It funds that research that then can evolve into practice guidelines that ASHP can take forth. It also does those milestone events that I will call them. The pharmacy practice initiative is the most recent, but even going back before that in my time to Hilton Head and the clinical initiatives, they provide that launch pad for us to initiate significant changes in pharmacy. And I mention those because those are all funded through the foundation. The other thing that the foundation does is a significant number of traineeship programs where we can offer an opportunity for individuals to get in-depth training in a particular subject matter, and that's something that, you know, we can't do as a membership organization. That relationship that the foundation has with other organizations that in many cases see a value in what we're proposing and are willing to financially support that as a not-for-profit is just extremely valuable. So I think the foundation is a huge asset to the practice.
And as a pharmacist, when I contribute, I can take that as a charitable contribution on my taxes, correct?
Absolutely. We are a 503C, I believe the right term is, but we are a not-for-profit tax deductible organization, so you can certainly claim that in taxes.
As you think back over your career thus far, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
Well, you know, Sarah, I think that goes back to what I was talking about, where do you get your joy? And I think I have been very fortunate in my career, and I haven't had a job that I have not enjoyed. But I think my greatest joy comes from opportunities that I've had to improve situations so others can be successful. When I work with a young pharmacist, young leader in various disciplines, whether it's in the practice of pharmacy, providing a service for a patient, or running a business, and we can lay a foundation that they can grow from and continue to expand their scope, their understanding, and the value that they bring to the organization. For me, that's the greatest joy, just seeing that organization move and the individuals within it progress. If I can lay that foundation and establish the culture by which they can grow, I get immense joy from that.
As you make these career moves, have you ever considered that you might fail at something?
I am going to fail. I can guarantee you that not everything that I've done has ever been successful, has always been successful. But what I do is I can take the things that I've learned from failure and apply those going forth, and I try not to make the same mistake twice. So I pride myself on not doing that very, very often. But I never go into a situation fearing that I'm going to fail. I go into a situation, focus on what needs to happen. Some people would tell you that I've got a laser focus on what needs to happen, and I can drive to where we need to be. That's where my energy is. I very seldom go in with, what if we fail on this? That's just not my personality.
It's kind of a mindset, isn't it?
Oh, if you let yourself get in the mindset of worry about failure, you take energy off success. And I tell my staff all the time, we want 100% energy on success.
You've reinvented yourself and your career. How does one do that? And you're kind of at a stage now of reinventing yourself again.
Yeah. And see, I'm excited about, I've got some time off right now and thinking about what's next. And I get excited about that. But, you know, I don't think there's any magic to this. As I have made transitions in my life from one role to another, one of the things that mentors have asked me, and you know, I ask myself, is what are you good at? You know, what fits well? What are those factors of your past roles that you found not only success but enjoyment in? And then how can you expand on that in your new role? And I think that as any of us go through these transitions, and trust me, all of us will, because I think that, what is it, 4 or 5 careers that the average person will have now, and with continued involvement of the healthcare system, we're going to change. But as you go through these changes, reflecting on your strengths and what you do well and how you can maximize that in your next opportunity, I think is key. For me, you know, I like leading organizations. I'm not afraid of going into organizations that need help turning around, change of culture. I do well with culture. I generally have a pretty clear vision of what the culture is, the culture for success will be. I'm a pretty clear communicator, so in terms of establishing expectations, that fits very well for me. I like building teams, so I'm not afraid to go into an organization that needs the team to be built. So, you know, those are the opportunities that I look for. I don't know what that next opportunity is, but I would guess that it would probably expand on that experience that I have.
You mentioned culture. Why don't you talk a little bit about what a culture is within a department or an organization, and where does it come from?
I think culture is set by the executives of an organization. And when I talk about culture, much of it for me personally is what I need and I think others need to be successful. So, for example, if you have a culture that people are not going to speak the truth, as an executive, you need to know you're probably the only one that they're not telling the truth to. Because the truth will be spoken. The question is, will it be spoken to you? So you need a culture that you set where the truth is spoken in front of you. And you start to do that by, one, inviting the truth, two, embracing the truth, and not punishing for telling the truth. Now, that doesn't mean that you know, people are offensive to each other or anything, because you can certainly tell the truth and be respectful. But you need that in your culture, because you're never going to be able to get the real issues unless you have it. Then there becomes this whole culture of credibility, and that's holding each other accountable. And for me, that's very simple. I told my staff, do what you say you're going to do. And as long as we all do that, people are understanding, there are clear expectations, and there are very few surprises. Then, you know, a culture of, you know, how do you make decisions? Do you make decisions after you have 95% of all the data and move, or are you comfortable with 70% of the data to move? And, you know, and that differs. When I was a practicing pharmacist, we needed 90%, 95% of the data, because it was a patient care decision. As I'm on the business side and we're developing a program, well, if I wait to 95%, then I've lost the opportunity. So that's a different culture in terms of how you use data and develop programs. So that's probably going to be a situational. But again, the dialogue that you have with the team and the setting the expectations of how you do that, that's all part of that culture. And respecting each other and honoring each other, and learning that, you know, I always used to tell the pharmacy staff, you know, everybody's job's important. That clinical, that pharmacist can make great recommendations and have them approved. We can prepare drug therapy, but if the drug doesn't get to the patient, none of it worked. So all of, you know, that entire chain of event is just critical to success, and I think you find that in just about every organization.
Bruce, I was intrigued with your comment about speaking the truth. What are some examples of when that has or hasn't happened and the ramifications?
Well, there are many examples of when it has or haven't, and I think we've all experienced several. But let me just go into my health system archives, and, you know, one that I think many of us have faced is really around medication safety and medication errors. You know, there have been number of times that somewhere in the process something may have gone wrong. To have that person that sees it, experiences it, or knows that there might be something there, to have them have the power to say, stop, let's go back and recheck this, is just very powerful, a very powerful culture. That can save an error, save injury, and maybe save a very catastrophic event for patients. So that person, for example, might be a nurse that has gotten a product that doesn't look like the last product. And instead of going forth with it, has the power to say stop. Or if they went forth with it and now feels that, hey, something wasn't right, having them have the power to come back and say, hey, I did this, I think it was wrong, let's quickly investigate this, is super meaningful, or the culture that you'd want to create. Or having a technician that may have prepared something and left the building on the way home, figures out in their car that, you know, I don't feel right about that. To have them call back in and say, I did this, will you check to make sure that that's right? Double check that. Having that, or even after an error may have occurred, to have someone have knowledge of what happened and have the safety to come forth with that knowledge. Now, that same scenario, I'm using a medication safety example there, but that happens in all departments. I mean, I've had it happen in our financial system that, hey, there's a number posted that was not what we thought it should be. What happened there? Someone knows the information, and that person just can come forth and we can have that discussion. Or we didn't deliver on a customer expectation. What happened? Who's the person that was involved that has the information that can come forth? It can save us all a lot of time if you've got that culture to come forth. So it happens all the time in our lives. It's just a matter of having that culture that allows people to embrace that. And then you get into the whole issue of how do you hold accountability? And, you know, that then becomes an issue of holding others accountable in your culture, and what does that mean? You know, there is no one that will come to work every day to be incompetent. You know, they may need extra training, or they may not be in the right role. And getting a person in the right role or out of the wrong role is as important for that individual as it is for your organization. And I think it's leadership that has to do that.
One of the things that often comes up in the medication use system is the pressure to do things quickly. How does that relate to being willing to stop and say we need to double check something?
I think that's a key part of your culture, Sarah, because if your goal is to do things quick and that's your priority, then you're likely putting safety as a second priority. So to the staff, it always has to be safety first, because I would rather provide a safe product than a unsafe product quickly. And having that known, but having that dialogue with the department, I think is critical.
Yeah, I would agree. Mm-hmm. We have a few minutes left. Would you like to summarize briefly what your learnings have been?
Well, thanks for the opportunity to do it. First of all, let me just say that, again, I'm honored and a great credit to you for creating this entire series. I think this is something that's extremely valuable for the profession, and I hope that this session proves valuable, a valuable part of that as well. You know, in our discussion, we've talked about my experience moving from the health system world to the corporate for-profit world. And while we talked about many of those skills that are transferable, communicating, connecting with individuals, creating the visions, and he had some of the challenges. In the for-profit world, what I learned that was a new learning for me is how do you manage that, you know, that account management relationship, the sales relationship, that it's all about taking what you do, packaging in a manner that others are going to find value in. And you know, if I was back in the health system world again, I would spend a lot of time on taking what I do, presenting it in a manner that all of my accounts, customers found value in. And I think that was something that I could certainly could have benefited from. I'll also tell you in summary, through my experience and my leadership journey, that whole concept of understanding where you get joy in your work was critical for me. Because if I'm an individual that I get my joy and if I need immediate feedback, then the staff role was a wonderful role. If you're an individual that you don't need or you don't find that you need immediate feedback for joy, and you can get joy from seeing others do well and creating systems that can help advance, then those leadership and broad scope responsibility roles, those executive leadership roles, could be very, very rewarding for individuals. And the last thing I'll say is, in summary, I'd like our students, our residents, to know that going into a formal leadership role is a choice. You will always have leadership opportunities in whatever you do, whether it's just leading the people around you and helping to grow others. But going into a formal leadership role is a choice, and you need to make your decisions based on what you get joy and where you find value in your practice from.
Bruce, these have been great comments. Thank you very much.
This has been wonderful. It's always nice to talk with you, Sarah.